Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
In this episode of the podcast, we're playing that much loved pub car board game, Dream 5 Car Garage. But we're going to play it with a little bit of a twist to make it more difficult for ourselves. Now, before we get stuck into the 5 Car Dream Garage game, Andrew, we're just going to do a few minutes on the race over the weekend, the 24 Hours of Le Mans, because last week we said we would. Now, we're going to keep it quite brief, I think, because, you know, not everyone watched the race, not everyone followed it, and certainly not everyone will be interested, but we'll just sort of run over it quite quickly. In last week's podcast, we did a bit of a preview, and we said we weren't forecasting a really epic, memorable 24 hours. Do you think we had that right?
Yeah, for once, I think we actually got something right. it was a pretty epic hour right at the end.
Yeah.
Hello, everybody. I spent an awful lot of my weekend waiting for something to happen. I think all the things that we kind of kidded ourselves might happen, like, you know, the rebellions could give the Toyotas a really good run for their money. And when the first Toyota had its turbo trouble, thinking, oh, that might happen to the second Toyota, and that may end up us having a proper race. Right out the front, it was, you know, we got ourselves into a situation where if that number 8 Toyota didn't break, it was going to win and win by miles, which it duly did. But I think that there was, in the other categories, I think there was a lot to be happy about. But yeah, ultimately, it just boiled down to, didn't it, after the end of that lengthy late safety car period right at the death, there was definitely some good stuff going on there, and it was a fairly absorbing last hour. But I don't think anybody will ever say it was a classic, and I guess that somewhat sweetens the pill of none of us actually getting to be there this year.
Yeah, at least there is that sort of silver lining. Yeah, so as you said, the number 8 Toyota did win. No surprises there, really. In LMP2, I mean, we said they would be, and they were really going at it all the way through the 24 hours. And as you said, in the closing stages of the race, it looked like we were set for a titanic duel, didn't it, between the Jota car and the United Autosports car that ultimately won.
Yeah,
but sadly, then, the Jota car had to go in for a splash and dash, and the race
and it was. I mean, my problem with the LMP2, it was, you know, for much of the race, although there was a fabulous race for between the AF Corsa Ferrari, which James Calado was driving, and the lead GT Pro Aston Martin. But in LMP2, because it's basically, it's visually, it's like a kind of a one-mate race series, and the cars all look the same, the sound the same, it's difficult to know who to root for, because, you know, unless you follow, you know, Le Mans, the WEC, and sports car racing very closely, you know, you look at all those LMP2 cars, and you don't know which particular car it is, you don't know which particular team it is, you don't know which particular drivers are in it, so it's quite difficult to invest emotionally in it. But, you know, if you see, you know, Ferrari versus Aston Martin, which was the big story in GT Pro, and indeed in AM, and, you know, the shapes are very obvious, and you know who the drivers are. And so I found myself being, despite the fact that, you know, the best racing was undoubtedly in P2, I found myself being rooting more for the GT Pro drivers and having more fun watching that than LMP2.
Yeah, you're right. Actually, how recognisable those GTE cars are makes a huge difference, doesn't it?
And yeah, it does.
When you're watching on TV, it doesn't really matter that they're not as fast as the other stuff. They look great, and you can immediately spot what they are. Yeah, it's interesting how that just sort of makes you tune into it and engage with that aspect of the race a little bit more.
So it also gives me, you know, great hope for, you know, if these hypercars, these alleged hypercars, turn up. You know, I was looking at the Peugeot announcement, which came over the weekend, and they were saying, you know, that they interpret the rules to say that they actually have quite a lot of latitude for allowing manufacturers to make cars that do look distinctly different. It's not just going to be a sort of one size fits all category, which, you know, I find quite exciting. But, you know, as far as that's concerned, then we will have to wait to see who actually comes out of the woodwork, because I think it's one of those great ideas. I think the, what do they call it, the LMDH category, so the Le Mans Daytona hypercar category, which is a sort of blend between IMSA and WEC, I think that is going to do really well, because, you know, those cars largely exist, and there are lots of players who know how to do that. But whether, you know, all these car manufacturers are really going to design these hypercars from scratch at a time like this is another matter. And also the regs are slightly odd insofar as, you know, you have to build road cars not before you can race them. You have to have built and sold 25 road cars by the end of the season in which you first race, and then 100 by the end of the second season, if my understanding of the rules is correct, and if indeed they haven't changed, because they seem to do that quite a lot. And so, you know, are Toyota and Peugeot really going to build 100 hypercars? And if they do, are they going to sell them?
it's a strange thought, isn't it?
I think it's a point worth making. I mean, nothing against Peugeot or Toyota, but, you know, people who spend huge amounts of money on supercars tend to spend them on, you know, Ferraris and McLarens and Porsches, in the absolute blue bloods of the sport. Maybe they can, but I haven't seen anything which says to me that Peugeot is going to find selling 100 hypercars to the general public a remotely easy thing to do, given how much presumably they're gonna have to cost. So God, I've gone right down a different alley here, haven't I? I'm really sorry. But yeah, no, I started, can't remember what I started talking about. But
yeah. So anyway, you were saying that hopefully these hypercars, you know, however that category sort of turns out, however it develops, hopefully we'll have a handful of different cars from different manufacturers that look recognisable, because, even to me, watching it on television, even the Toyotas and the Rebellions look quite similar.
Completely correct, yeah. And indeed, the Rebellions look quite similar to the LMP2 cars.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Well, there we go. And I mean, a huge amount of credit, though, to Aston Martin winning both GTE classes. That's fantastic. We were there last year, weren't we, when they got absolutely stiffed by the ACO on the morning of race day.
In the same way that Porsche got stiffed this year. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Their race was ruined, wasn't it? By, you know, they had their boost taken away, didn't they?
Sadly, you know, all that sort of regulatory wrangling. It makes me wonder what I'm watching.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, absolutely right. Fair play to it. I mean, sorry, kind of a big shout out for British teams, because there were four categories at Le Mans this year, and three of them were won by British teams. So, United Autosport, won P2, and Aston Martin Racing won GT Pro, and TS Sport won GTM. So, you know, I think that's great. But at the same time, you know, we know that Porsche were really, really quick this weekend, and yet their car couldn't get out their own way during the race. And we knew last year that Aston Martin had, you know, a good package, really good package, actually, in quali. And then, you know, they came nowhere during the race. And so what you're looking at is not the difference between, you know, one car manufacturer doing a better job than another car manufacturer, which is what absolutely you should be looking at. But, you know, puppeteers pulling strings and manipulating these things, and almost as if to say to Aston Martin, well, you know, you got stuffed last year, so it's your turn this year. Or this is just to make up for completely rolling you over last year. And yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not going to say that is what's happening, but you would definitely be forgiven for coming to that conclusion.
Yeah, I find that slightly tricky. A big shout out from me to one of the drivers in the Aston Martin AM car, the winning car, Charlie Eastwood, who's a young lad. He actually drove the car across the line at the end of the race. And a few years ago, I did a 24-hour race with him. I shared a kart with him. And he's a young guy, but he's good company. He's good fun. I think he did the first stint for us in the kart. This was at Daytona at Milton Keynes. He did the first stint, and then he buggered off to see his girlfriend. He drove to Norfolk or something to see her.
I'm glad to see he's got his priorities on the right order.
And then he eventually made it back just in time to do one more stint before the race was over. So I was just pleased to see him winning at Le Mans.
Presumably you blew him into the weeds.
No, I was utterly, utterly hopeless. I'm not a particularly good karter anyway, despite owning one that I've only used a few times. I find it too physical, and I think I move about in the seat a lot, so I get really beaten up when I'm driving them.
I stopped doing it, and my excuse, which is quite a good excuse, is that I, you know, put me in a cart, and that cart suddenly weighs 100 kilos more than it did without me in it. I can remember doing one with the auto car mob, you know, back in the day with Sutcliffe. I think it was pre-Harris, but look, and it was one of these. I'm not sure. I think it was a 24-hour one. I remember that. And it was a long race, and you know, I think I did the first stint, which I don't know, was 40 minutes. And I was foaming at the mouth when they pulled me out of it. I could not get out of the car. I had to be pulled out of it. I didn't get back in it again because I was done after one. Not only was I done after one stint, I was so slow. Frankly, they didn't want me back in it. So, and I've not been in the car since.
I can relate. Yeah. So when I did this 24-hour race a few years ago, they were in, you know, pretty decent two-stroke cart, so with quick engines, and some of Daytona, the Milton Keynes track, is pretty bumpy, and I found that after one lap I was thinking, oh my god, my arms are done, I can't really hold on to this thing. I've got 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And of course it hurts, and you just sort of carry on, and actually, before you know it, the 40 minutes are up and you're out of the cart.
Now we've disappeared down another completely different alley. Can I tell you my karting story?
Yes, you can.
So, would you be glad to know this has got nothing whatever to do with me? I was doing some kart race somewhere. And it might not even be one of these things where you just go and hire a place and you'll cock about in carts. And we did that. And there was a sort of an interval in the middle of it when they sent out the young kids, you know, to just to sort of have a whiz round. I wish I could remember where this was. All I can remember about it was there was this young black kid who was just in a completely and utterly different world to anybody else like that.
It was.
And the terrible thing is, the only reason I remember this was because he was black and therefore he looked completely different to anybody else in the building. And just thinking, this guy's amazing. And so I remembered his name. And it was. So there you go.
Wow. So what did he go on to achieve?
Not much. Six world championships and counting, with a seventh on the way. Yeah, so that's my karting story. Anyway,
hang on. I've got a karting story. This is going to sound slightly immodest, but it's also true, so I'm going to say it. Although, is it immodest? I don't know. You're going to have to let me know what you think. So years and years ago, I was probably 20, did a karting event. It was like a BMW were involved somehow. But anyway, we were down at Nigel Mansell's kart track in Dorset, and he was there.
I hope this goes the way I think it's going to go. Keep going.
So I did a kart race against Nigel Mansell, and I can't remember if it It might have been the case that we all just went out there and bombed around for a bit and came back in. I don't think it was a properly sort of structured race with a start and, you know, all that stuff. But anyway, I do remember I'd sussed out which one was 1992 Formula One world champion Mansell.
Yeah.
And I wasn't near him on the track, but there was a part of the track where, the circuit sort of doubles back on itself and you could see the other part of the track. And he was there. And I was always at the same corner when I saw him. So that meant that he was circulating no faster than I was.
Exactly. Yeah, you'd catch him.
Which I'm quite pleased about. However, he was, you know, what was he? He must have been mid-50s or something then. No, 50 maybe back then. A slightly bigger bloke. I don't think he probably did much karting when he was a kid. So yeah. I don't
but
know,
he was also Nigel Mansell.
He was Nigel Mansell.
Yeah. Hey, I look at you in an all-new way from now on.
There you go. I am a hopeless carter, though. You know, I think, I don't know, maybe he was... Well, he clearly wasn't trying, but I'm utterly hopeless in a kart. I find it too physical. It's pathetic, really, but there we go. Anyway, so we've totally distracted ourselves with karting stories
yes.
there.
Yes.
We need to get back onto this game that we promised we were going to play. I hope... that yours is full of sort of esoteric old stuff that I've never heard of because I fear mine's a bit too predictable.
Okay, so mine's got some old stuff in it. In fact, quite a lot of old stuff.
Yeah, I've got a couple.
In fact, mostly old stuff. But can we just establish the ground rules? So this is money, no object. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But does whatever your list is, does it have to have a daily driver in there?
Well, they're the only cars that you have access to. So,
okay,
you know,
so you have to have something you can use every day in there.
Well, that's entirely open to interpretation. If you've only got GTO Ferraris and, you know, whatever, you're going to have to use one of those every day. And if you're prepared to do that, then that's fine. But
okay, but you've got to be honest about it. You'd have to be able to put your hand on your heart and say, yes, I would honestly be prepared to use a 250 GTO every day.
Exactly.
And also the other rule I'm going to impose in this I'm going to pretend I don't have children because you don't have children. Because otherwise my daily driver would have to have, you know, I'd have to have an estate car or something. So, to even out the field a little bit, I'm going to make that assumption.
Okay. And how many times has your list changed?
It hasn't, because this list has been in my head for 30 years. There are one or two cars on the list which weren't around 30 years ago, so they've kind of evolved a bit.
Yeah, okay.
I spent days agonising over this. In fact, I just wrote it down.
So yours is quite a steady state thing then? Mine isn't. Mine fluctuates and changes. I vacillate back and forth all the time.
Yeah, but okay. Mine only changes a bit when we apply the twist, which we haven't spoken about yet. So,
Yeah.
And it changes a bit, but anyway. So, how are we going to do this? Are you going to kick off?
No, I want you to kick off, please.
So, do you want me to name the five cars, or do you want me to go through each one, or the justification for each one? How are we going to play it?
Yeah, I think I want a full explanation and justification before we move on to the next car.
Okay, so car one is the F40. Okay, the F40 is there because it's the greatest road car I've ever driven. And I don't think I really need to justify them in terms other than that. It would make me beyond happy to know that I owned an F40. There is a bit of an issue over what you do with an F40. But I think it's one of those very rare occasions where I would find stuff to do with it. And when I wasn't finding stuff to do with it, it wouldn't, like most of my cars do, just make me feel guilty about not driving them. I think I would just be so stoked about owning an F40. So that's the F40. Okay?
Fair enough, yeah.
Okay, next one. Because I love really old sheds, I have to have a really old shed in there. And so the particular old shed I would have is just a really nice, open, touring 4.5 litre Bentley from about 1929. I happen to know these sorts of cars quite well. I love their engineering. The way Bentley used to engineer things is because, you know, metallurgy wasn't what it was, because knowledge wasn't what it was back then. He basically over-engineered absolutely everything, because that way he knew it wouldn't break. So he made things actually massively better than they needed to be. There was one, after one 24-hour race, which Bentley won in the 1920s. They stripped down the engine of the winning car, measured everything, and at the end of it wrote the stripped down report, which read, in total, nothing to report. So they put the engine back together again and sent it off to go and do some more racing. And I love that total engineering approach. And if you drive those things, they are so mechanical. They keep you so busy. And also, you know, they just don't break. I mean, I've got a mate who's got one, and he's been, I mean, literally almost everywhere. And he's done Peking to Paris. He did Peking to Paris, and he had a problem with a batch of inner tubes. He then drove it the whole coast of West America, and it literally nothing went wrong. And he's done not tens, probably hundreds of thousands of miles in these things, and they just keep going. So that's the Bentley.
That story of your mate. I was about to ask you what the hell you'd do with it, but it sounds like you really could use it and go on.
You could do everything.
Massive adventures.
But that's the thing. You could do anything with it. You could take it to the pub. You can race them. You can do massive events in them. I mean, they are unbelievably usable. You can put your kids in the back of them. You can do anything you like with them. And you don't lose your license in them, because ultimately, you know, they won't do more than, a really good one might just do 100 miles an hour. So, you know, they're great.
Good shout.
So the next one is, the next two are bracketed because you can't have one without the other. Okay.
Oh, hold on.
No, just bear with me, okay? Okay? I'm not going to say... I'm not going to say...
Are you talking about the Fiat Brava and the Fiat Bravo?
You know me too well, Dan. Okay, so... obviously, I have to have a racing car in there.
Yeah,
And frankly, you know, when I think of racing cars, and I know so many people who feel like this, the racing car I want is a Lola T70 Mark III B. For any of you out there who is not sad enough to know what a Lola T70 Mark III B is, go and look it up, because it is one of the most indescribably beautiful things that you could ever imagine. But it was a late 1960s sports racing car. It rather got blown into the weeds by things like Porsche 917s. But they were so beautiful. They make an incredible noise. The thing about the Mark III B is I have driven one years and years ago, and I drove it as hard as I could, and I felt that's my level. I thought that I could just about manage to race one of those. I've driven quite a few things that are quicker than that. I mean, they're still, you know, 850 kilo car with 500 horsepower, so they'll definitely keep you on your toes, but no downforce. And if you get into things that are materially quicker than that, yes, I can drive them around a track. Yes, I might even be able to drive them, you know, reasonably respectfully in terms of, you know, how fast they could ultimately go. But I wouldn't want to race one. Whereas a Mark III B, absolutely. And it's also a monocoque, unlike things like 917s, which are space frames, which means if you hit something, you at least have a chance of surviving the experience. So that's the Lola. And obviously, because you've now got a racing car, you've got to get it to the circuit.
Yes.
So you need a tow car. So you have to have a G-Wagon, don't you?
Interesting.
So that's the fourth car. So that's the fourth car. So you have a G-Wagon to tow the
Which
Lola.
Which one? Which one?
Diesel. I mean, I would, you know, there's a bit of me which says, you know, oh, of course, you know, you've got to get the 63 with the, you know, with the whiz-bang twin turbo V8 in it. But in fact, you know, can you imagine the fuel consumption of one of those when you're in a bit of a hurry towing a Lola? I mean, you'd be stopping at every other service station, and that would just, even if I was rich enough not to care about the cost, I that would just cheese me off. So I'd just have a nice, dark, diesel G-Wagon. And so that's four done, and the fifth car is the Daily Driver, which, of course, is a manual GT3 Touring. I mean, it couldn't be anything else, could it?
Interesting that you should say that.
Yes.
Okay, well, shall I go through mine, and then we'll apply the twist?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right, well, I'm starting with my Daily Driver. And so what I've gone for, it's a very original one, this is a 911 GT3 Touring. I mean, honestly, it's the first one on my list.
And dear listeners, can I just say, I promise you, Dan and I have not compared notes in advance in any way, shape, mean or form. This is as news to me as it is to you.
It's interesting, isn't it, that's the one that leaps out. We should probably explain it a little bit. Let's get stuck into the GT3 Touring for a moment. I'll explain my sort of reasons for choosing it. Well, it's got that spectacular engine and the manual box to go with it. So it's got an amazing powertrain. I love that it looks much subtler than a normal GT3 with a big rear wing. And particularly if you have it on in a slightly muted tone, maybe a black. And on Harris had one on gold wheels, didn't he? Which looked fantastic, but it wasn't subtle. But I think if you've got a black car...
More subtle than his current one.
Yeah, the yellow one. Yeah, that's true. But I think if you've got a black one with silver wheels, you know, you and I will know and people listening will know. But to everyone else, it's just a Porsche.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing... just really appeals to me. I love that, you know, it's a bit more under the radar than, you know, certainly more so than a GT3 RS. It's much more me, actually. They're great to drive. They're not so hardcore or so noisy that they're a pain in normal driving. Actually, far from it. They're fine. It ticks so many boxes. Does that pretty much sum it up for you?
Absolutely. And I think it's a rare and special car. You know, you mustn't forget that this is a car with, you know, a manual gearbox and a normally aspirated engine, and a wonderful normally aspirated engine and a wonderful manual gearbox. And how many of those are left? You know, I was driving a Bullitt Mustang the other day, and it suddenly realised to me that the Mustang is now the only manual rear drive normally aspirated V8 car you can buy. And these cars are dying, and you know, I think we must just enjoy and celebrate them while we can. And otherwise, yes, it's absolutely what you say. They're just wonderful things to drive. I certainly don't need a car to be faster than that. They handle beautifully, but they are, and you know, they also, you know, they ride well enough. They're quiet enough. They are genuinely usable daily drivers. I mean, I know someone who does do that, and he just loves it. And I would just have a sort of dark grey, definitely debadge it. Everything you say, just make it subtle and discreet as I possibly can, and keep it forever. Just do all the miles and thing. Do 150,000 miles in it. You know, just imagine how happy you'd be, and it would probably still be worth something at the end of it. Because by then those sorts of cars may not be around anymore.
So why one of those over a 911R?
Because a 911R is rare and special, and something in my head says it's a recreation, it's a collector's thing. There is something which makes me think in my own weird way that a GT3 Touring is a more usable car, because I wouldn't mind doing all those miles, damaging it, and that sort of thing. Whereas in a 911R...
Damaging it? What have you got in mind?
Well, you know, shit happens, doesn't it? Stuff it just happens. You know, I'm not the world's most perfect Parker. You know, I could damage a wheel or some idiot could take the nose off. I mean, you just don't know, do you? And I wouldn't... You know, if I was in a 911R, I would, and also, you know, I suppose if this is a money no object conversation, I suppose it doesn't matter. But in fact, of course it does. And you would be thinking about the value of the thing and the miles you're putting on it and the effect that was having on the value in a way that I just don't think you would if you had, you know, a GT3 Touring, which, you know, as you know, as well as anybody, is a car that was made in as many numbers as Porsche thought it could sell.
Yeah, there we go. I think that explains why both of us, without having, you know, consulted one another, we've chosen that car. It's a mighty thing. Okay, so now that I've got my... And that is my daily... Oh, it's your daily car as well, isn't it? Yeah, so we've both chosen the GT3 Touring as a daily. And the second car that I wanted once I had my daily was actually a racing car.
Good.
And I want something a bit older. I've never driven one of these. But just having watched lots of footage of them, it looks like exactly what I want from a historic racing car. And the point for me is that I want this car to share with mates at Goodwood and other places like that.
Yeah.
It's all about doing it with mates. Because, I just think that would be actually more fun than driving the car itself, maybe. And I think, at the moment, I want a Lotus Cortina.
Oh, okay.
When I've seen them, particularly at Goodwood, because it's such a flowing circuit, and they're sort of nose to tail, and they're drifting through the quick stuff, that's the kind of driving that I want to do.
Yeah,
that's what it's all about for me, really.
Mega cars, never driven one, but I've chased enough in races and watched enough. You're absolutely right. I think they would just be. Would it be important to you that it had provenance? Because obviously most of them aren't Lotus Cortinas at all. They're just old Cortina shells that have been Lotus-fied. Would it matter to you that yours was an ex-Jim... I mean, you got all the money in the world. Why not?
Well, that's true.
The ex-Jim Clark Lotus Cortina. Or would you be happier with a car that was made last week from an old shell. And then you could think to yourself, if you smash it to pieces, it wouldn't matter because you weren't destroying history.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God, I perhaps need to give this a bit more thought. I think the most important thing to me, and I'm not suggesting that a car with provenance would be any less reliable, but I just want it to be tough and strong and, you know, usable, because I don't want something that's, you know, just going to let us down at the start of the weekend, because that's just, it just defeats the whole object, doesn't it? So, yeah, if it was built last week, that's absolutely fine for me.
Good. Yeah, no, I agree.
Okay. Well, I've got my daily, I've got my racing car. I do want a proper classic. I've not driven one of these. I've picked out a few cars that I've not even bloody driven. I'm a fantasist. But I want a Ferrari 250 GT short wheelbase, just because I think they're maybe the most beautiful road car there's been. I've watched one racing. I wouldn't race mine. It would be for the road. And I just, you know, drive it into town and park up outside a restaurant and just feel like the coolest man on earth just for a moment. I think they're absolutely stunning. Those engines are, those V12s, they're the gorgeous, best. Aren't they?
Yeah, the best.
Yeah, I'd adore having that thing, and I probably wouldn't use it that often, but when you did wheel it out, it would be so special, wouldn't it? And you'd feel incredible.
Would you do distances? Would you and the missus? Because that's the difference, the major difference. You're not racing between a short wheelbase and a GTO. Is, you know, it does have, you know, reasonable amount of luggage space. It is, you know, it's not particularly quiet and comfortable, but it's sufficiently quiet and comfortable that you could do. I mean, would you and the missus just get in it and just bugger off around Europe for a fortnight? I mean, wouldn't that just be over the mountains and?
Yeah, yeah. It's perfect, isn't it? That's just
heaven.
Yeah, exactly. That's what. Yeah, you're right. It's for you know, popping out on a Sunday at home, but then also doing big, long driving trips through the summer. Yeah,
so to be used for either very short or very long journeys, and nothing in between.
Exactly right. Yeah, no commuting. Okay. Well, you've mentioned my missus, and that's why my fourth selection will be a Singer DLS.
Because, that's lovely.
Yeah, well, she works with Singer, and she's an engineer, and she, you know, she coordinates lots of the suppliers, but she also specs the cars with the clients, and I think it would be great fun to sit down with her and spec our car.
I'm amazed you haven't done so already. What are you waiting for?
Well, interesting you should say that, because I've got all the samples in my living room. All the leather samples, all the paint colours, everything, all the, you know, bits of bright trim options, they're all in my living room, and I do flick through it from time to time just to go, would that work with the duck egg blue? And, you know, I've had a bit of insight into the project, and the engineering that's gone on into it is staggering. You know, they've made the ducktail spoiler work, because it never really did in period. They've done a four-valve head, which was never done in period, on an air-cooled engine. And I think it just looks spectacular, even just static. I think it's such a great-looking machine. And I'd absolutely love having one of those. And I think it would sit somewhere between the classic, the 250 GT short wheelbase, and the modern 911 Touring. Because it sort of is a combination of the two, isn't it? It would have a bit more of a classic car character than a modern supercar, for instance.
Am I at this stage allowed to call for a steward's inquiry on the grounds that you've got two 911s in your list?
Well, you didn't say up top. I've thought about it. I did wonder if that was cheating a little bit, but
I think that's shocking behaviour.
Well, the rules need to be clearer.
Two 911s. Dan, I'm a bit disappointed, to be honest. But, you know, I suppose I should have put it up front. I should have said up front, you cannot have more than one type of a particular.
I feel like such a hopelessly predictable car journalist.
And so you should.
To 911.
And so you should. Well. Anyway, hang your head and move on to your next car.
Final car is, and because, yeah, well, you went for the G-Wagon, didn't you? So I'm having a full-fat Range Rover.
Okay.
Because, well, probably some towing the Cortina.
Yes.
And the Ferrari when it breaks down. But also, there are times, aren't there, where you don't want, you know, talkative steering. You just don't want a great soundtrack. Bad weather, long journey. You just want to get in something with heated seats and, sit back. And a full-size Range Rover for me is the one.
Okay, I can see all the others. The full-size Range, I can see the full-size Range, it's fine, but it interests me for those purposes that you would have it over, an S-Class or a Flying Spur or even a Conti GT or something like that. So does the bigness and the SUV-ness and the off-roadiness of it count in your book?
Yeah, it does. I'm thinking winter weather, you know, sometimes that would be a factor. But also, I do want something that I can bundle a few mates in, a load of stuff in the back, you know, big road trip with friends. Yeah, I'd want something with the space to do all of that.
And tow your Cortina.
And tow the Cortina. So there we go, my five cars. We now have to start applying the twist, and we're going to start with yours first. And the twist is that you have to get rid of one and explain why, and then get rid of another one, and then another one, until you only have one left.
Yeah. Okay. That's fine. Shall I commence?
So what are you culling first?
I'm getting rid of two, but I'm going to add one. You see, that's the way I roll. That's the way I think, you see. I'm not just going to... There was no rules which said you just had to get rid of one and then another. It's a five-car garage and then a four-car garage and then a three-car garage. So I'm getting rid of the Lola, and having got rid of the Lola, I don't need the G-Wagon.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
So that's the thinking, okay? So I haven't got a racing car anymore, but I need a car I can race, okay? So I have to have a racing car I can drive on the road. So I'm going to get a pre-65 FIA spec short wheelbase 911.
Another 911. Hang on. You've now got more than one 911.
Yes, I thought you might bring that up.
You utter hypocrite.
Yes. I did know this when I cried foul at yours. The short wheelbase 911. The first time, God, I'm going to sound like such a twat, but the first time I raced Le Mans, I did the Le Mans Classic for the first time. I've only done it twice, but I did it for the first time, I think, in 2010, and I was meant to be racing something quite whizzy, which didn't turn up. Or it was broken or something. Anyway, the person who owned it said, I'm really, really sorry, but don't worry, I've got a 911 for you to race instead. And I thought, Le Mans, short wheelbase 911, I just thought that's going to scare me. But, you know, there was nothing else, and it was the choice of racing at Le Mans, don't. So I got on this short wheelbase 911, which is actually the same car that Christopher raced at the Goodwood Revival and Howard Donald owned, and it was just a peach. I literally knew from the first lap that it wasn't going to cause me any problems at all. And it was such a beautifully set up car. It wasn't the most powerful. It had like 180 horsepower, but it had a nice Tuthill tuned, very tractable engine, which revved up to sort of seven and a bit. But it sounded incredible. The handling was out of this world. And I just felt so at home in it. And I can remember thinking to myself, I could just do anything in this. I could collect the kids from school in this. I could go on a big road trip in this. It's like the Bentley, really. You could just do anything in it. And my point would be, every time I'd raced it, I'd just have to drive it there and back. And I was so happy in that car. So yes, absolutely. I have broken my own rules, and I now do have two 911s. But yes, so out with the Lola, out with the G-Wagon, in with a short wheelbase 911.
Right, okay. So let's just clarify that you have so far selected six cars for your five-car garage.
No, I don't see it so much as that. As a four or five car garage and then a four car garage, and I've just got rid of two and put one in.
Right, okay. Well, okay, I'm calling foul, but you're going to disagree, so we'll just have to get on with it.
Yeah, I think, can I refer you to your earlier statement about getting the rules out up front?
Well, yeah, I know, that's why we're going to have to wave play on, isn't it?
Okay, I won't do it again, okay? I will just reduce by one from now on.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm just so interested to see if we're both going to end up with the same. We are just going to both end up with the same car. But yeah, let's see. Keep going.
Okay. You've now got four cars, so you need to get.
So I've now
got
an F40, a 4.5 litre Bentley, a short wheelbase 911, and a GT3 Touring.
What are you losing?
Oh, so I'm going down three now, am I?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. The Bentley. I mean, I love the things. I really, really do. But I'm not so much losing it as keeping the F40, the short wheelbase, and the GT3, because I can't be without a GT3. I can't imagine. I can't be without a racing car, and I can't be without an F40, because life wouldn't be worth living. Let's face it. So,
okay.
So by default, and not through any fault of its own, the Bentley's going.
Okay, fine. You've said you can't be without an F40, you can't be without a racing car, but you now have to get down to two cars, so you're going to have to be without one of those.
Yeah, well, it's the F40, isn't it?
What, you're losing the F40?
I'm losing the F40 because it's the one... because I have to race, and it's also... even back at the five-car garage, I always knew the F40 would be the one that I'd use least. It's the one that is most difficult to use because... you really do need the right kind of environment in which to exercise that kind of car. And I would be frightened about, damaging it. And it's a real occasion car, isn't it? It's a car for a specific purpose. It's not the sort of car that you just wake up and think, oh, I'll go and drive the F40 this morning. So the F40 is gone, which leaves me with a short wheelbase 911. And a GT3 Touring 911. So having said you can't have more than one 911, I've now, my last two cars are only both 911s.
Okay. And ultimately, you have to get rid of one more, because and it leaves you with just one car to use for everything.
Yeah, well, so the racing car has to go, doesn't it? Because I don't race all the time, and I do drive all the time. So my one car, for all purposes, all reasons, and I could go and do track days in it, and everything else, I would, the one car I would keep without any question at all. I'd love to say, oh, it was such an agonising decision, but it wasn't. It was dead easy. It was the GT3 Touring.
And there we go. So we've whittled you down from 5 to 1, with a little bit of cheating going on in there. And you're left with the GT3 Touring.
I wouldn't call it cheating so much as just sort of creativity.
Right, okay. Well, okay, so it's the Adrian Newey approach to the rule book,
precisely,
isn't it?
Precisely.
Okay, bending the rules without breaking them. All right, well, I need to get down from 5 to 4. So I think the first one to go is the Range Rover, because ultimately I can use, a GT3 Touring for normal day-to-day duties, apart from it's not a big car. It's only got two seats, but out goes the Range Rover.
How do you get the Cortina to the track?
Well, that has to go next. So, I think, so the Range Rover and the Cortina probably have to go together. So I'm from 5 down to 4. That's down to 3. And then it gets quite tricky. I think I'm going to get rid of the DLS just because I don't want to also be left with two 911s like you were. Because imagine that. Imagine if we both got down to two 911s apiece. I mean...
Does your singer engineer other half listen to these podcasts?
I don't think she does, but there's a chance she can hear me through my bedroom wall. So she might have taken
when you said get
now.
Rid of the DLS, I'm sure that went out terribly well.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I'm sorry, Imogen. So that's gone. So I've got a 250 and a GT3 Touring, and I've got the same predicament as you, haven't I? You had an older car from the 60s that only had limited usability, and so have I. So that has to go, and I'm thoroughly disappointed that I'm left with the same car as you, because everyone listening to this, they're just going to go, well, you're all dyed in the wool, aren't you, and you've got no imagination.
I think I'd be right. I mean, hard to argue against, to be honest.
Guilty as charged, yeah.
Guilty as charged, but I mean, what else could... I mean, okay, here's a question, and okay, the justification I completely understand, because it is money, no object, but, you are the proud owner of an Alpine A110, yeah?
Yeah.
But it's not on the list anywhere. Whereas, could that not be your GT3 Touring?
It could be, but if I'm talking, I love my car. I was driving it yesterday on some roads that I know near Castle Combe, and that's when it's at its best on slightly bumpy B roads. And you just, the chassis works beautifully, and it's, it even steers well, and it was absolutely sublime. But if we're talking one car for everything, or, dream cars, it doesn't have the powertrain, does it? Being brutally honest.
Being turbocharged with paddles.
Yeah, it's a facilitator for the chassis, isn't it, that drivetrain? So I think that's why. I think that's why. But there are a couple of interesting themes. Neither of us have a modern supercar. I don't think the GT3 Touring quite counts, but no 720s, no F8s.
No, it's all about usability, isn't it? If I had one, I'd have a 720S, because having been lucky enough to live with one of those for a few months last year, I do know how usable they are, and I do know how lovely they are to drive slowly, and that to me is the key point about that car, which people just miss again and again and again, because you tend to get in them and drive them like your pants are on fire. But it's because they steer so nicely, because you can see out of them so well, you know, they are just cars that you can use daily. And I did, you know, it was my daily drive for 6 months. I can't believe, even now it seems like a distant dream, but, you know, they are beautiful, and, you know, they've got lots of luggage space. The interior works well. Yeah. So, but yeah, but actually, you know, the GT3, the problem with the McLaren is that you just worry a little bit about it. I mean, I can remember leaving it in long-term car parks at Heathrow and just being a bit sort of twitchy about, you know, and you couldn't get it into a, you know, a multi-story car park at the supermarket. Maybe if you were that rich, you wouldn't need to. But, yeah, no, ultimately, you're absolutely right. No hypercars at all.
Yeah, strange one, isn't it? I think that probably speaks volumes, actually. All right, so that's the five-car thing. We're going to play one more quick game.
Yeah.
And I'd like you to quickly set out the rules, please.
Okay, so Dan wants me to set out the rules of this game because I sprung it on him about 30 seconds before this podcast started. So whereas we knew about the 5-4-3-2-1, he had no knowledge of the last twist to the twist, which is a three-car garage, okay? But you have to keep a daily driver in there, and the budget for the whole lot can't be more than 50 grand.
Oh, I'm going to struggle doing this off the top of my head.
Okay.
So, okay. Any more rules that we need to clarify? Presumably not allowed more than one of the same, you know, nameplate?
No. Let's say that, because that doesn't inconvenience me in any way. So, yeah, you're not allowed one or more of the same nameplate. And I think just as long as you've got yourself a daily driver in there, then no, that's fine. So, I want to go through this quickly because I don't want you to have time to think, because I'd love to hear you struggle at the end of this. So my daily driver is going to be, and these are obviously needs to say all secondhand. So my daily driver is a really nice Golf GTI. Okay, Mark 7 Golf GTI, 20 grand will buy you a beautiful, nearly new example of that. Probably might even get a Golf R, actually. Might even get a Golf R, slightly older Golf R. Yeah, you know, five doors, manual box, bish, bash, bosh. That's the daily driver. The fun car is a Caterham, because as per anybody who's listened to this podcast recently, I'm a bit of a Caterham evangelist at the moment, and I just love their simplicity, the back to basics, and basically everything I want in a car in terms of not only how fun it is to drive, but actually ultimately how usable it is, because it does have things like a roof and a heater and side screens where things like Atoms don't. It's all wrapped up in a Caterham. So that's my fun car. And then, of course, there's the old shit. And this I actually own. I cannot imagine, like, any circumstances other than, you know, being sent to the workhouse, in which could persuade me to sell my 2CV. My 1958 425cc 12 horsepower 2CV. It is the most charming thing imaginable. And as I have said, maybe not on this podcast, but certainly elsewhere about it, it is impossible to be unhappy and at its wheel at the same time. And so every time I ever got a bit down on the chops about anything, I'd just go and drive the Citroen, and then all is well with the world. And you could definitely, absolutely, categorically, very easily get all of those 50 grand. Dan, over to you.
Oh, crikey. Yeah, you've done well there. You're now going to hear me squirm and... I don't know.
That was the plan.
You've absolutely sprung this on me. Okay. Daily driver. No, do you know what? I'm going to start with the fun car. And I want to go rallying, actually.
Good.
So I'm... And I think because I want to... I actually want a front-wheel drive rally car, but with a good tight diff. Just because... I've not done much rally driving at all, and so I don't want anything that's going to be well beyond me. And I think what I would have is, a few years ago, there was a Ford Fiesta ST Championship. This is when, you know, a much older ST with the 2-litre normally aspirated engine, 150 horsepower.
Yeah.
And, yeah, they built a rally version of it. And I think you could probably get one of those for... I don't know, maybe 10 grand or something. I'd have to check, but they built a few of them and they were never that expensive to begin with. So maybe it's 15 grand or something. So I've got my Rally Fiesta. I need a slightly more practical everyday car. You've gone with the Golf R.
Which can tow the Fiesta.
Yeah, exactly. You've gone with the Golf R, so I can't have one of those.
Well, you can. We both ended up with 911s.
I know, but I'm just trying to be a bit more interesting than I normally am. I would have So I spent 15 grand on that. What else is there?
There's not all roads lead to golf.
They do. They just do, don't they? If you can't think of a car, just say golf. There'll be one that does the job.
Yeah, at a low budget, think golf. At a high budget, say 911. That basically covers everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. Okay, so I think I'm just going to have to go Golf R because, yeah, four-wheel drive, lots of power. You could probably tow with it. They're great to drive. Brilliant everyday car. Yeah. So, sorry, I'm copying you and having a Golf. And because I've got a front-wheel drive car and a four-wheel drive car, I then need a rear-wheel drive car for fun. What have I spent? I've probably spent 35... I've probably got 15 grand left. And I'd hope the best... No. I don't know. It's a good shout. I don't know. I'm going to regret this. But at the moment, it's the best E46 M3 I could find.
Very good call.
Get a CS for that? Maybe not quite.
You won't get a CS, but you'll get an absolute pearler of an E46, and yeah, good call.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. It's not bad.
Lovely,
is it?
Low mileage car. Yeah, absolute
manual.
Yeah,
manual. 18s coupe, spot on.
Yeah. Blimey.
Okay, well, I'll have to remember for the next podcast that you absolutely stiffed me with that.
I play dirty,
springing that game on me. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, listen, We've played those two games. I think I just want to do one more thing and talk very quickly about dog names.
Oh my goodness.
Just because we went to see our new puppy yesterday, who comes home with us in 3 weeks' time. And it's all very exciting. And as you know the excitement of looking forward to bringing home a puppy. And inevitably, because both of us are terrible car bores, the name has to be somehow connected, doesn't it, to cars or car people.
Ideally, and this is the trick, ideally without the rest of your family realizing it.
Exactly. Yeah, you get it past the family, and then you can know forever that it's actually a car name, but no one else should. So that's why Enzo, for instance, is too obvious.
Yes, absolutely. Enzo would be great. What about Colin?
No, well, it could be... No. Yeah.
Colin works brilliantly. No one would realise who you're talking about. And you,
yeah,
oh,
Gordon.
You, I might have to do that. Gordon. We see Gordon would be good.
Bruce.
Ken. Oh, there you go. I may have to go out and get some animals now.
Well, so you currently have a Dino, don't you?
I have a Dino, yes. I have a Dino. I can't claim that anybody doesn't know that Dino is named after Enzo's son. But that was sort of a collegiate thing. Dino came along when my children were a little bit older, and we just put loads of names down. And to be fair, the reason he's called Dino is because it wasn't actually my choice. I didn't think of it, and my younger daughter just loves names like that. So Dino was on there, and the moment I saw it, I thought, well, that's the name. And at which stage were there? There are four of us. There are two daughters and my missus, and that was 50%, and we would always be able to vote them down. So Dino was. But before that, Dino's mum was Lola. And I reckon that nobody knew about Lola because, you know, it was to the older generation, i.e. me and my wife, of course, it's a Kinks song, isn't it? And it's a song which we've liked and jumped around to lots of times. And to my children, you won't know this, but there's a children's book, which if your children of a certain age, they would have grown up reading a book called Charlie and Lola. And so Lola was the Lola out of the book. And to them, to my wife, it was the Lola out of the Kinks song. And to me, obviously, it was a now sadly defunct Huntingdonshire-based sports and Formula car manufacturer.
There you go. So that's a good example of sneaking a car name past the
sneaking a car name. But I think in terms of being sneaky, I think you've done even better, because when you told me what your new mutt is going to be called, I didn't even get it. And in fact, I said to you, I actually said to you before this podcast started, Dan, you missed a trick here, mate. You've chosen the name which isn't related to cars. And you went, I think you'll find.
I think you'll find. Yeah, well, I think we're going to go with Otto, which is, I mean, for me, it's after Nicholas Otto, the German engineer who basically invented the four-stroke cycle that underpins the combustion engine. But it's just quite a cute name. Also, Otto is the bus driver from The Simpsons.
Gosh, I hadn't thought about that. Yes, and a bus is a kind of mechanised vehicle, so there you go.
Yeah, do you know what? The Simpsons writers are so clever, I'm sure they did that intentionally. I swear it. So we think we're going Otto. I do worry that it's a little bit 1910s era Germany, and there are certain connotations, but I think
von
it's
Bismarck.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's late 19th century.
I'm putting a late bid in for Colin.
I'll see if I can get it past my other half.
Yeah, you won't.
We'll report back.
Imogen's got far too much taste. in the certain knowledge that at some stage I'll very good mate Colin Goodwin will be listening to this.
Well, do you know what? It's interesting that you mention Colin again, because it was Colin who one day said to me, if he was going to do a high quality car magazine, he would call it Otto.
Would he?
Yeah. So it's very much Goodwin's idea. And I've stolen that name.
So when Goodman's talked to me about magazines, he's going to. They've been called what small
block? Practical Formula 5000.
And Practical Formula 5000. So he's obviously moved on to Otto. Personally, I prefer Practical Formula 5000.
What small block?
What small block?
That's classic Goodwin, that isn't it? Oh dear. All right. Well. We haven't done dog names on this podcast before, but there we go. We're sort of branching out a little bit.
Yes, good.
We'll have to do some more of that stuff. Anyway, that was fun. I just need to rattle through the calls to action. That's what they're called. And please, everyone.
Otherwise known as give us your money.
Give us your money. Yeah, patreon.com/DriveNation. Thank you to everyone who has done so already. You can just bung us a little bit of money each month, which makes a huge difference. We've got really big plans, and having a little bit of cash coming in makes all the difference in the world.
It genuinely does. And we have been, you know, touched and surprised by how many of you have been kind enough to lob us a bit. As Dan says, it means a lot to us personally and professionally. It means that we can get on and do so much of the stuff that we've not been able to do up until now.
Exactly. You know, all the rest of the stuff. Rate the podcast, leave a review, please. That stuff actually makes a huge difference. It could be the difference between a podcast really taking off and never quite doing so. Everyone who podcasts will tell you that reviews and ratings make all the difference. So please do that and tell your friends. That's the last call to action. Tell your friends about Drive Nation, about the podcast at DriveNation_ on Instagram. And we're done. We're finished.
Good fun this week.
Yeah, it was. And we will talk to all of you again next week.
Look forward to it very much.
Goodbye.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.